Hello and welcome to A Week in the News. I'm your host Chris Scott and I'm joined as always by Kate Proctor and Mike Kelly. Alright guys.
Hello. Hiya.
And welcome to a five more years edition, I suppose. Kate, we'll start with you. We're a week removed now from the general election and the result. Did the Tories win the general election or did Labour lose it?
I think you can say without doubt that the Conservatives won the election. I don't know what happened. I don't know whether if you're in the North East you're just in such a Labour bubble, but clearly, you know, when it came to polling day, the Conservatives, you know, stormed ahead. And I think that narrative that they have put in, everything they've done really over the last 5 years is really stuck in people's minds. It's just little things, you know, that constant reminder of we inherited the deficit from Labour. Labour left us in this mess. We're the ones that are putting us back on track. We're getting the economy sorted. We're fixing it. I felt among social media and people on Facebook, they were sort of trotting out those lines verbatim. And so I think Conservatives won in that sense. Whatever message they've been trying to get across over the last 5 years, I think it truly stuck when it came to polling day.
And say it often enough, then it becomes the truth.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Well, how bad is it for the North East and the Tories in power? As you said, we're in a bit of a Labour bubble, Kate. But in the last Tory government, the North East had 50,000 new jobs. So is it as bad as what the North East are trying to make out?
Well, I don't think that, you know, it's difficult in our job because we speak to leadership quite a lot. So we hear it from their point of view. No, but plenty of people on the street are perfectly happy with this result. And like you say, it could mean really big things. You need to make sure this Northern powerhouse, though, that George Osborne keeps talking about, really extends to the North East. And we're going to have some more detail later today on new devolution deals for cities as well.
It's worth keeping an eye on, definitely. Mike, you were in the office with me on Thursday night when the exit poll results came in. Were you surprised?
I wasn't actually in the office, funnily enough. I just left to get my train back to Darlington. I left at 5 to 10 in high hopes. And I got back to Darlington by about 11:15 and I walked into my house and my partner had a face like thunder and I said, "What's wrong with you?" And she just pointed to the screen like some horror show was on. And I looked and there was the exit poll. Incredible surprise. Hindsight's a great thing, so we've now been able to analyse it and say, well, actually it wasn't that big a surprise, but at the time it was astonishing. You actually picked through it. I think I've spoken to people afterwards and they said it was obvious that the Tories were going to win, mainly because they focused their attack, as Kate said, on the economy, and also it showed that Cameron has proved himself to be a very effective Prime Minister. In all the polls leading up to the election, it showed that when it came to who was the best, when it came to economics, it was the Tories, and who was the best leader, it was always Cameron, despite Miliband putting in a great showing. It was a case of he's actually performing a lot better than we thought, so we probably had low expectation from him.
Yeah, I think we've said it before on the podcast that my biggest concern in the debates and the whole run up to the election was that there seemed to be a lot more focus on the economy than there was on people, and that annoyed me. And I think what the result shows is that people still, after 2008, don't trust Labour with the economy. Is that fair enough?
I think they haven't been allowed to trust Labour with the economy, because there's always this message that the Conservatives inherited a mess from the Labour and it's all Labour's fault, which it's the facts don't bear that out. The reason why the economy was in the mess was because of deregulation. The banks were allowed to run amok and
nothing's changed.
It's still the same system in place, yet the people who were paying for it are the people who suffered once the economic recession started. The so-called benefits cheats, the public sector, they are seen as the causes of it, yet they are the victims of it, just like we are. So if Labour wants to progress from here, it has to get that, change the narrative, and actually defend the people it's supposed to.
This is interesting because a lot of talk since the general election has been, where do Labour go from here? A lot of people saying Ed Miliband, probably the most left Labour leader since maybe Foot. Do they reclaim the centre ground? Tony Blair wrote in The Observer that he thinks they should go back to the centre because they're being too left. It strikes me as odd, Kate, that if you look at England, they've been accused of being too left for the English, but if you look at Scotland, they've been accused of being too right for the Scottish. Surely you can't be both things at once.
No, I don't think you can, and I think it's going to be an extremely difficult, actually quite pivotal time for the Labour Party. They're going to have to crystallise what they mean and what they stand for, and it could be a sort of like a Tony Blair style shift that sets out the Labour discourse for the next sort of 20 years. But yeah, this summer it's going to be formed really, and I expect it'll be a drift to the centre. I mean, Ed Miliband didn't work, and actually I don't think that, you know, I don't think his policies were overly left. Personality on Ed, I think.
Yeah, if not, I mean, there's arguments that they're actually too right wing the policies, because you see the person who's now being ordained as the next leader, although we also see Chuck O'Mono, was taught, when he talks about benefits and austerity cuts, it's not, there's probably a cigarette paper's width between him and what the Conservatives are talking about. So perhaps they're looking at it at the wrong, coming from at it from the wrong direction.
I think that's more fuel to the fire that Labour are the party of Tory light. They're not the progressive party, and I do wonder whether does Labour hinder left progressive politics in this country.
I can't believe you'd say they're the party of Tory light. That just seems to have turned the whole, like, if that's what it appears to be.
I think so, and I think if you look, I think let me justify that a little bit. If you think of austerity and the campaigning that they did in Scotland, that there was very little that I think you could choose between. I think if you polled a lot of Labour voters across the UK, a lot of them would say they're the only viable left wing party, so they had to vote for them very tactically to try and keep the Tories out, because they couldn't vote Green, because they didn't have a chance of winning. So I do wonder sometimes whether Labour hinders left progressive politics.
I just wonder whether there's the appetite for that anymore, and I think that's possibly one of the most significant things.
The SNP probably showed that in Scotland, obviously.
Okay, so in England I don't think it's there anymore. And obviously it all just depends on how well these parties get out there and represent what people feel, or it's almost like unearthing what's beneath people and how communities and societies want to exist. But I think, you know, what is an English voter is a really, really conflicted thing at the moment.
Also, how you frame the argument is, sometimes I sort of react against sort of terms like left and right. I think mainly
obviously,
it's
about Tony
fair.
Blair wasn't left. Like, no. we've not been talking about left and right strictly for a long time.
It's about fairness, really. That's what the message they should be getting across. I mean, a lot of what Miliband was saying was good about making society less unequal and addressing the iniquities of that, but the message didn't get across, because his way of expressing that was to bash big business, big business, but business in general, which caused some concern that all business is bad. It's not. That's one of the things that he was tarred with, the fact they were anti-business and anti-aspiration. I think they need to look at how their arguments are framed and perhaps put them a bit better. There is potential in the Labour Party to do that, but it's whether they can realise the potential after the next leader is chosen.
I think aspiration is an interesting one, because I think that's what Tony Blair wanted to point out, that Labour should be the party of aspiration as well, because for Labour to come out and campaign on zero-hour contracts and minimum wage and stuff like that, a lot of people don't see themselves in the job that they're doing right there, and then that's getting the minimum wage, or they're on a zero-hour contract. They don't see them doing that for the next 5-10 years. They're thinking, well, I'm going to be richer in 5-10 years, so, you know, that's not a chief concern, possibly.
Well, that's the way you should frame the argument. That's not so much the aspiration, what people can achieve, it's what they want to be achieved for the country. So you start, as a starting point, say, we don't think... I mean, some zero-hour contracts are beneficial to the people who have them, but it's only a small amount of them. Say, yes, we should make sure all zero-hour contracts are fair. We should address the iniquities at the bottom, people who aren't paid or haven't got job security. And then you say, well, once you've got this established, society can progress. Why is it good for society that people have job security? The reasons for that is to boost the economy. People get paid more, put more money into the economy, the country benefits. Less is paid out in benefits to people who claim tax credits. You should frame it like that to see how putting that right can benefit the rest of us.
Certainly. So, disaster for Labour. That's without a shadow of a doubt.
Yeah, they'll admit that.
Yes. If it's a disaster for Labour, what is it for the Liberal Democrats, Kate?
Well, Yeah, that was quite incredible and, again, unforeseen because, I mean, I, for one, thought they'd maybe go down to 20 seats. I didn't think it would be all the way down to 8. What I think about the Lib Dems is that sort of locally, where they've got council seats, they have a real history of really embedding themselves, holding their council seats and actually being really good local councillors. So I can see that that will build up again. I find it just astonishing, though, that people seem to have punished the Lib Dems for the coalition in the way that they have, and that the vote has gone against them. So so if you just look for, like in Scotland, Danny Alexander losing his seat for the Lib Dems, I really felt that he had been put forward as the face of austerity cuts and the face of George Osborne's you know, financial kind of strategy, and yet he's the one that loses his seat. And I felt that was played out across the country, and I thought that was extremely harsh from people who were voting in those Lib Dem marginal seats.
It was a very canny game played by the Conservatives, showing them to be the more experienced party. Let's face it, like Kate said, Danny Alexander was put forward as the face of the guy who did all the austerity cuts. George Osborne was very much in the background.
Yeah, and used and abused.
Yeah, that's right. So the Conservatives said we could have achieved more if it wasn't for the Lib Dems holding us back. And the Lib Dems, they were blamed for the more regressive Tory policies that were brought into place. The Conservatives played a blinder in the election.
Well, it certainly shows... Oh, it's interesting. Now the Liberal Democrats are out of government, that we're going to see the true Tory party. I suppose they've got no human shield to hide behind when they're introducing policies. David Cameron can't point to Nick Clegg and say, "Hey, it's nothing to do with me." You know, we've got a barter here. So, what can we expect from the real Tory government?
More of the same, but worse. I mean, two things. One is, yes, they haven't got the Lib Dems to rein them in. Secondly, David Cameron, he's going to resign after this Parliament, so he can do what he likes. And thirdly, we've got a very divisive Labour leadership contest coming up.
Yeah, I can't believe it's going to take till September. I just think that's so, far too long.
That's going to be a really big problem, as being pointed out. One is the uncertainty will just drag on. Secondly, the Conservatives are talking about hitting the ground running with all the policies. They need someone in place to fight against that or to put the opposition voice. But it looks like till September, the Labour Party isn't going to have a leader. So who's going to organise any fight against it?
Well, who will be leading the Labour Party until September?
Harriet Harman.
She's going to step up from deputy leader until someone's elected.
Well, no, she'll just remain as deputy leader.
Okay.
So she'll... But she's not interested in being leader.
No.
And she'll be fine, but it's just, you know, it's that organisation thing, like you say. And, and as, you know, Conservatives are going to use this summer as best they can, you know, around recess. But they're going to try and storm things through, I'd imagine. And not just that, I think this is going to be such an interesting time because I do want to bring up the Lib Dems again. They've got their leadership contest as well. And I know Tim Farron has said he's in the running. He's popular. But when you've only got 8, how much of a voice are they going to have? I mean, you don't really hear the DUP if they've got 8 or 12. I think they might have 8.
I think it's in double figures. I can't remember off the top of my head. But
well, how often do you hear of them? Yeah. You know, when you go down to below 10, surely that's you.
Well,
kind of finished.
In some context, they're not particularly bothered about Westminster politics, it seems. Sometimes they're more concerned with Northern Ireland. But the Lib Dems have got a problem, a credibility problem. I think they were hoping to hold the balance of power after the election, but no.
And, you know, some of them have great experience, and it's something that I actually think could really strengthen Labour.
I think it's interesting, isn't it? You know, we're talking about this, and obviously, of the two main parties in Parliament in Westminster, the Labour Party having a bit of an identity crisis, and we're waiting to find out what the identity of the Tory government actually looks like. So it's going to be interesting to see how it unfolds. With Labour then, if we're talking about going back onto the leadership race, who do we think is the favourites now?
It's difficult to say, really. I mean, some interesting polls have come out after the election. For example, we were talking about Labour should reconnect with aspirational politics. But polls show that its middle class support actually held up during the election, the so-called aspirational class. It was his working class vote that went. They were plummeted.
In which case I think Andy Burnham could be strong for that.
Yeah.
And then I think Andy Burnham and Chuka Emunah stand out for me. I think they're poles apart, though.
Yeah, I have my doubts about Chuck O'Mahony. Perhaps it's because he sat on the couch last Sunday next to Lord Mandelson, who seemed to anoint him the next leader. It makes me deeply suspicious. Andy Burnham seems the best one.
But is Andy Burnham too much of the Ed Miliband era?
It's difficult, isn't it? I mean, is he tarnished by that? What about Yvette Cooper? Is she tarnished by being the wife of Ed Balls?
Yes, she is.
Gordon Brown, who's linked to Tony Blair.
Yeah.
I don't know. Liz Kendall, I don't know much about her, to be honest with you, so... what chance has she got? She hasn't been in Parliament long, but a lot of people say a lot of good things about her. She comes across well in the media.
Yep, she's liked within the party. She's quite good at falling out with people, apparently, but without making enemies of them at the same time. It's quite a good strategy.
It's a good thing that she knows her own mind and she doesn't try to foster good relations with everyone. She stands up for herself. It's always a good sign. As for who would be the best leader, it's difficult to say. Andy Burnham is the one who seems to link most of the disparate parts of the party. Chuck O'Mahony, I'm not sure about him at all. Something about him that I don't quite warm to. It'll be very interesting to see how the contests will progress.
It's two different types of politics, isn't there? If you're looking at
the two leaders. It's such a shame, though, that it can't seem to be one more kind of unifying force. He seems to be, you either have to go... Because the whole point is now they've got to try and fuse their working class and middle class supports.
Yeah.
And I still can't see amongst that group of one person that represents that, really.
Mm. It was interesting, Ian Lavery, our local MP, he didn't have his hat, wasn't going to throw his hat in his ring. He said that actually people approached him. He said he had quite a lot of support from the trade union movement, obviously as a former president of the NUM. And he said also a lot of MPs had said they would back him if he was to stand, but he said that he'd never said yes, he'd never said no. He was approached, but he's now withdrawn any potential candidacy and he's come out and backed Andy Burnham.
Right.
So that's interesting.
Just going on, you mentioned the trade unions then, Mike. If Labour do go back to the centre or even push right of centre, is there any threat of the trade unions leaving Labour or withdrawing their support?
And shift it to who? That's the question.
Form their own party, possibly. Mm. Who knows? That's what this is the thing.
Well,
does it represent their interests?
RMT were backing, in not so many words, but I think they were backing the Greens, weren't they?
Yes, the Greens, and then there was the Trade Union Socialist Coalition, which sunk without trace.
Yeah.
But I think they're natural bedfellows with Labour. They will have fallouts with Labour. They have done in the past, they will do in the future, but I think they'll stick with Labour. They'll have some influence within. Of course, they will, because they helped form the party in the first place.
But they won't have as much influence as they would have done before the 2014 reforms, would they, for the Labour leadership? I think they've got to register as Labour supporters now, rather than just getting an automatic vote, haven't they?
One person, one vote.
Yeah.
Well, ironically introduced by Ed Miliband after he got the votes of the...
Even though he got help,
But he saw that one coming, because he tried to do that to escape the red Ed label, but that didn't work.
That didn't work.
So, I think, Kate, you were telling me that, was it Nick Forbes, described the North East as a red blob in the sea of blue, was it?
I can't remember whether that was me or whether that was him when we had a chat, but that was the nature of the conversation, was there's the risk of the North East being cast politically adrift because it is now such a small sort of red island surrounded by a sea of blue Conservative seats. So I think what's essential for the North East now is devolution, city-based devolution, and that's where you'll get your strength. All of the core cities are Labour, and we'll hear in a minute sort of what George Osborne is offering in more detail. But I think in terms of power and rebuilding, I think that's going to be key for the North East. And we've got to make sure that I think in really simple terms that the North East tries to get on as well as it possibly can with this government. Otherwise, it's going to suffer massively. We're absolutely out on a limb here.
Yeah, there's two ways it could go. One, North East could be totally ignored by the Conservative Party. But however, this week, I mean, I'm not quite sure how they work it out, but the North East is supposed to be the fastest growing economy in the country. And unemployment has fallen to 7.5%. That's a massive fall from this time last year. Granted, it's the highest in the country. So perhaps the Conservatives might see the North East as a way of proving they have considerations for the rest of the country, say, despite it being Labour, we'll do what we can for Labour up in the... do what we can for the North East. I mean, after all, James Wharton is the golden boy up here now out in Stockton South, so...
Well, that was the Prime Minister's first visit, wasn't it?
It was.
Came up to Stockton South, and I think has he been put in charge of the Northern Powerhouse?
Apparently so.
I'm not really sure what that means at the moment, but we'll see.
It's a good phrase. It's a good phrase.
Yeah. Speaking of the Northern Powerhouse, I remember speaking after the budget, and we said about the devolution that Manchester enjoys, and we said, well, if the North East wants to probably enjoy the same, we possibly might need a mayor. Is that still the case?
Well, I think that's definitely what's going to be put out there, that Newcastle needs to accept the Metro Mayor model to move forwards with its devolution deal. From what I'm hearing, Newcastle is not in favour of that. So, I mean, that's the battle, and then we'll just have to see how that plays out, because if that's the bargaining point, then Newcastle got to decide whether to be in or out. I guess the reticence about the mayor is understandably in the North East. I mean, who's that going to be? We've already we've got so many layers. We've got the combined authority, we've got the LEP. Could it be someone from business? Well, I feel like we've almost half been having these debates already, but to actually have the government say you've got to choose a mayor, that's going to be really difficult.
Yeah, political expediency might mean they'll have to bite the bullet and do it. Otherwise it looked much like, probably mixing metaphors here, but to cut off your nose to spite your face. Just if you want to get involved, you've got to take part. But it's problematic, to say the least, how they will actually go about that. But like I say, time will tell.
So what's the argument against then? Just too many layers of government?
I guess from a Labour perspective, the worry of the mayor is that it's someone who isn't Labour. So you end up with a structure where you're actually weakened in power because you're having to fight against someone who's in a different political party. They could be an independent businessman, they could be an independent businesswoman, they could be Conservative, UKIP, they could be just a personality in the North East that people really love. It could be Ant or Dec, it could be like anyone.
Well, that'd be interesting.
Yeah, that's right.
Can they share the job? Is that possible?
They can do anything.
They're coming in tomorrow, so that we'll ask them.
They're coming into the Chronicle offices tomorrow.
Yeah,
we'll ask them about their political policy.
Well,
too many layers for me. That's my point of view.
Speaking of weakening Labour power in the North East, Mike, we've been talking about this before, is a bit of scaremongering from the left, I feel, that people are talking about what it means when the Tories want to redraw the constituency boundaries. Can you just give us a little bit of background on that?
Well, as part of the manifesto, they wanted to do it in the last Parliament, but they didn't because the Lib Dems blocked it because it was so beneficial to the Conservatives. They wanted to redraw the boundaries, reduce the amount of MPs to 650 to 600, which independent analysers have said would probably lead to about a 40-seat swing to the Conservatives, so you can see why they're keen to do that. I don't know if their hyperbolic reports say if they actually get through with that, the Conservatives will never be voted out of Parliament because it would just concentrate so much power within their hands. So it'll be interesting to see how that actually shapes up.
They could never be voted out.
That's the theory. Of course they can. Of course, if they're particularly bad policies. But the way, after winning the majority at the last election when no one predicted it, with 650 constituencies, that if they cut it down to 600 and the new shake-up even more favours them, you can see why people might jump to that conclusion. So it'd be interesting for Labour to see how that develops.
It's scary. I don't know what else to say. We'll finish with this. There's a lot of talk, as you said, Kate, about rushing through a load of policies in the next 100 days before, you know, Labour pick their next leadership. Do we know what type of policies they're going to try and rush through?
Well, they'll make some headway with Europe, the referendum. I know the cities bill, the devolution, that's on the agenda as well.
The most concerning one is the big question about how they're going to achieve their £12 billion cuts, only £2 billion which were identified before the election. Now they've actually got to come up with the figures to follow that through. I mean, there was talk that they'd only came up with that figure, so expecting a coalition probably with the Lib Dems again, so Lib Dems to hold them back on it. But now they haven't got the Lib Dems to stop them, so they've got Ian Duncan-Smith back in the DWP. He's going to follow it through. So that's going to be the biggest concern, the Queen's speech, even more so than the EU referendum. I think it's how these cuts are going to, where they're going to come from, how quickly they're going to come about and who's going to suffer.
Free schools as well as a pledge, which probably in terms of getting something through quickly wouldn't be too difficult to roll out, the expansion of the free school model.
Yeah, but like we said before, this is David Cameron's last term as Prime Minister. He wants to be seen as a go-getting Prime Minister. Yeah. Nothing to stop him. And waiting in the wings is George Osborne, probably giving a prod and a poke to get all this stuff done. So expect a lot of activity.
I think for me, like what this election has showed is I feel like we've had just in the last 10 years such a massive shift in, like I said at the start, in what is an English voter, what is an English person's political views, and I feel that, you know, obviously the Conservatives spoke to all of those people, and that was the party that people wanted. And I think living in the northeast of England, you do feel separate from that.
I think it's the north of England, really, isn't it? I think if you look at the map of the seats, it's yellow at the top for SNP in Scotland, then it's red from the border all the way down to just past Manchester, and then from then on it's like a blue. Yeah. So there is a real big north-south divide at the moment, I think.
Yeah. I'm just surprised, having worked here for the last 3.5 years and you write so much about austerity and how the cuts are affecting people, to see that actually elsewhere in the country that's actually not of similar concern. I found that really illuminating, and I felt as if I don't quite understand what the rest of Britain is thinking.
I think when it comes down to it, people vote for two reasons. One, for themselves mainly, and two, for the good of the country. I think the latter is probably a small percentage of it. So a lot of people were just voting for themselves. They thought, you bet the devil you know. And if you look at the statistics, it's a bugbear of mine that while we say the people were listening, the people were supporting the Conservatives, you actually break it down. There's 46 million people were eligible to vote. Only a quarter of them voted for the Conservatives, yet they have a majority in Parliament. It's a frighteningly small figure for which was afforded them to wield so much power. So the problem is...
That was UKIP's argument, wasn't it? That they had something, 4 million votes, or was it? Or something?
They had 4 million votes and about 14%, or 13 or 14% of the vote, and they got one seat.
Compared to the same amount of figure for the SNP, and they've got 56.
Well,
I know it's slightly different.
Well, the UKIP said they had more votes than the SNP and the Greens combined.
Yeah.
And the SNP, of course, got 56 seats. Yeah. The Greens, 57 seats. They've got one. Not Nigel Farage, sadly.
Right. Well, we'll know more this time next week, obviously, after George Osborne.
I think we'll have a few more policy announcements.
Yeah, so we can kind of see how the new government and the Labour leadership race is shaping up. So make sure to join us then. Thanks very much.